This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Here's how we start. I want everybody in the room, here's my standing assumption here, everybody has something, a difficult situation in their life. New, maybe last year, maybe long-standing, 25 years, maybe the person's alive, and maybe they're not. But I'm going to assume that everybody has something difficult going on right now. You hurt them, they hurt you, it's hanging, it's painful, it's hard. First thing I want you to do is visualize and identify that person for yourself. Now, I understand it could be 20 people, but let's stick to one. As we go through this, I want you to stay with that person. I want you to think about what happened. I want you to think about what happened after what happened. Because every single person here has what I would call a forgiveness style. How you communicate, how you apologize, how you pardon. Everybody has a way they do these things. There's no such thing as generic forgiveness. Because every forgiveness scene, every single one, whether it's big and dramatic or small and trivial, is based on the idea of exchange. What is it that I want out of this? What would I want afterwards? What am I willing to give up to get what I want? What would I be willing to give up in order for me to apologize? What would I be willing to give up in order for me to forgive? What's the agenda of the two people who are facing each other? Are they on the same sort of page or wavelength? With that in mind, we can begin. We're going to begin by looking at four models of forgiveness that are laid out by the professor of philosophy at Hebrew University, Moshe Halbertal. Okay? The first model is what he calls Stoic forgiveness. We all know the word Stoic from the English language, which is basically in the vernacular, come to mean taking things in stride, stiff upper lip, a little bit unemotional. Person is stoic, right? Stoic forgiveness in some ways is the easiest. It's also not that common. What you do in stoic forgiveness is your goal is to separate yourself from the person who hurt you. You just want to cut the tie. You're taking up rent-free space in my brain. That's what it comes down to. I'm thinking about you, I don't want to think about you. And what you're willing to give up to separate is everything. In other words, I don't care if you apologize, I don't care if you change. I just want us to move apart. So if you read with me, number one, and this is obviously much easier to do with people who are not in your life on a constant basis or even at all. First approach sees forgiveness as an expression of control. That's what you want. You want to gain back some sort of inner control. You forego what's due to you. You don't even ask for an apology. You don't care. They apologize. They don't apologize. You forgive them to let them go. It's a break with the past. It's an expression of independence. You don't want them controlling your inner life. It does not entail any change in their part. You're not looking for something to happen. So, as I said, it's a model that's often works best with not such a deep thing, right? Person taps your fender, you go out, you look, it's nothing, okay, forget about it. Right? I let you go. Or somebody you see very rarely who did something once that annoyed you, and you just say, okay, fine. Most of us are not in that position. Or if we are, we can handle it. Most of us are in the position of the second category he talks about, which I see as really two and three are the key. Okay? And I'll sort of write them down in stages. One is stoic. Two is what we call forgiveness as restoration. The theory here is that what we want from the other person is not actually, or not exclusively, or not even largely, an apology. What we want is validation. People have all sorts of ways of apologizing that actually make you feel worse than you did before they apologized. Right? And the reason is because they didn't actually validate you. So you say to somebody, and I want you to think about your people. Don't think about me, think about your people. You say to them, that really upset me when you did that. Whatever words you use, that hurts. I don't like it when you. And they say back to you, you're too sensitive. Have you ever heard that before? Or, why do you take things so seriously? Or, I didn't do that, you did that. Or, you turn everything into an issue. Everything's an argument with you. Or. What ends up happening is that you're traumatized the first time they did it to you, and now you're re-traumatized because they've completely invalidated you. And what invalidation means is isolation. Because the worst feeling is that you think that you wake up and you think, like, I'm nuts. Because I know this happened and I know it's painful, and that person just refuses to acknowledge that I'm alone. Like, I'm the only one who knows this. Because they refuse to, like, buy into it. Or, if they give you an apology, it's like a big fat favor. Like, the other code word? Has this ever happened to you? Well, if you feel bad, I'm sorry. Just more invalidation. It's not true. It's your thing. It's your shtick. But okay, so that's like a non-apology apology. So forgiveness is restoration, Albert Hall argues, is really what everybody wants. He gives a very interesting example from recent political history, right? South Africa, after apartheid falls, there's grave concerns in the country about what's going to occur on the level of civil violence. Right? Because after years of oppression, the black community is enraged, there's real fear, there's going to be blood in the streets. So they set up what's called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You can look it up. Truth and Reconciliation Commission is this very radical thing where the victim and the perpetrator both go out in public and the perpetrator testifies, confesses publicly, this is what I did. Whereas to restore to the victim not just an apology, but the truth. In other words, I am validating publicly. You are not crazy. You had it right. I am wrong. And that's what they would do over and over and over again. So as Albert Hall writes, you can read with me in the second paragraph. The injured making his confession before the injured becomes his partner and describing what transpired between them. More than a few victims feel isolated in their reading and assessment of their situation. Not only have they been wronged, they've also been denied recognition of that wrong, a denial that undermines their sense of reality. You feel like you're crazy. You're alone. Right? In studies of certain trials in the United States, this is very common in rape trials. Right? Horrific thing happened, and now the horrific thing gets doubled because the argument is you're crazy, it was consensual, you're crazy, it didn't happen, you made it up, you did this, you did that, right? So that's invalidation, not even no apology, no validation. That's what we really want. Think about your relationships, like, no BS. What really you want is you want them to say, not just I'm sorry, but like, I get it, I was wrong. There may be all sorts of reasons. You're going to have a long series of discussions after that. But Jewishly, that's what we really want in forgiveness scenes. People really, really trivialize the notion of what this process is. Oh, so you mean I'm supposed to, like, say I'm sorry and they forgive me? No, actually. You're supposed to get to the heart of the matter with your person, which actually can take a long time. It may not happen at one time. It may take 2 times, it may take 10 times. May take 1 month, may take 5 years. There is a process here. And the dirtier, the messier, the uglier, the more painful it is, the longer it takes to unravel in a way where you get mutual validation, which is not simple. I've said this before in, you know, other lectures. There's a very, very crucial set of decisions that a person has to make in their life, in which they're thinking about that other person and they're thinking about whether they will ever get validation. It's a hard thing. You see they're constitutionally incapable of it. They can say, I'm sorry, but they're really not going to do it. And then you have to decide at a certain point in midlife, do I stay or do I go? That's one of the things that people face. But in a less dramatic way, because most forgiveness scenes are a little less dramatic, you just have to decide, like, what do they want from me? Why is it that when I said I'm sorry, they're looking at me irritated, frustrated, annoyed? Why is it that and that's where the real argument begins. Like, I said it. That's not what they want. They want you to own up. They want you to itemize. What did you do, right? If you look at transcripts of how married couples fight, and certainly psychological literature, one party will say, okay, I'm sorry for what I did. And then the other party will say to the therapist, what did you do? I don't believe. I think you are so clueless. You don't even know what you did. You're just apologizing because you don't want me to like rag on you. So you just apologize. It's like apology as like thrusting me away. You can see it in people's body language, right? Okay. Right. Which is like, I want to get the hell out of here. I don't want to deal with this. So here's your apology and leave me the blank alone, right? So of course you don't feel fulfilled by that, right? But it is a truth that sometimes it is hard to validate. And one of the reasons it's hard to validate is that you feel like you want validation too, right? So I'm a Canadian originally. So the national religion in Canada is?
Sorry?
What's the national religion of Canada? Hockey. I know it's officially lacrosse. Right, so if you know hockey, right, two guys go in the corner. One guy goes in with a stick high, spears the other guy in the groin, referee misses it. Second guy, like, elbows, punches him in the face, referee calls the penalty, right? It's called the retaliation penalty. Second guy is enraged, the whole bench is enraged, the coach is enraged, they're screaming. Did you see Bobby Clark take a stick and break the guy's ankle, which happened in 1972? That's what people do to each other. Right? It's very, very important to see that piece, right? You are right when you said they yelled at you. You are right. It was hurtful. They should apologize. Are you also cognizant of the fact that there's this thing you do every time that you just poo-poo dismissed that leads them into this rage? That was the spear in the corner that nobody talks about. So sometimes it's hard for them to validate you because they correctly believe you should also be validating and owning some of the things you do here that contribute to this circumstance that got me so frustrated. I'm not defending the fact that I did something hurtful to you, but a reality check would be that there is a reciprocal interaction going on all the time between us. And that is the third model in the Halpersall, called forgiveness as understanding. And sometimes to get validated, you need to understand the other person's position, not just as a technique, not a scam, because it's true. Because two people are in a relationship and two people are doing stuff. Some people, when they're hurt, unconsciously like the position, right? In other words, here I am, victim. Here you are, injurer. It's vertical, right? I am righteous, you are not. I'm never gonna let you forget that, ever. I'm here, you're here, don't you ever forget it. I want us, it's crazy, right? But I want us to be in this position, even though it hurts, because I get to do this over you every time. If forgiveness is understanding, you completely change the dynamic, right? And the change is, it's all horizontal now. It's all fluid. We do things to each other. people say things like, how do you know you're getting forgiveness and understanding when the person says, now that I think about it, I can see why maybe you got upset in that situation. Maybe if I was in your shoes, I also would have gotten upset in that situation. And what you're doing with forgiveness is understanding is you're moving back towards validation. Right? If you're stuck on the validation level, if what you want from your friend is what you do not get because they're not validating you, one of the things you try to do is to see, will they have enough security and confidence to move to validate you if you do some validating of them? It doesn't always work. It's very individual. You have to think about the person in your head. Think about whether this has taken place. Think about whether it's always been high-low as opposed to across. But that's the forgiveness is understanding model. Right? Now, it's obviously based on certain perceptions you have about them, which is that the thing they did is not constitutive of who they are. Right? That's a key one. To put it bluntly, they cheated, but are they an adulterer? They lie, but are they fundamentally dishonest? Right? Is the thing behavior you got just a one-off, a bad day, series of circumstances, is it who they are? Because if it's who they are, you have a real decision to make here about what you want to do and what you'll be capable of achieving with them ever. If it gets too split, it's very hard to forgive. Like, you know, I'd forgive you, except you keep doing the same thing over and over again, so it's meaningless, right? That's a bad spot to be in, unless you move to number one and you're stoic about it and you say, I know what's going to happen, fine. Because you made some sort of private calculation, it's worth it to you, but you understand you will not get validated, and you understand that they will not understand you and you're not looking to understand them, and you know, it's not a great situation, but that's what it is. So what I'm saying here to summarize before we move forward is that when you think about the thing with the person in your head, how you've spoken to each other, what sort of code words you've used, what upset you, what upset them, think about how you're operating with each other. Every single person in your life is subject to your forgiveness style and theirs. And you are combining, you are colliding at that moment. And whether it works or doesn't work is based on our ability to see like whether the avenues we've chosen work well. And we're going to spend the last part of what we talk about thinking about what are constructive ways of moving the dialogue forward. Okay. Let's turn the page. Do a little brief exercise. What are my usual expectations of how a forgiveness team should go? What do I usually expect when somebody hurts me or I hurt them? Do I want an apology or do I want validation? And do I validate others when I apologize to them? Do I want something that I don't actually give that freely to other people? So just spend a minute. One of the things that comes up a lot in this topic is the feeling of, why should I? Why should I forgive them? They're, you know, I don't know if they're apologetic or not, but like, I don't see that they deserve it, or whatever sorts of language you use in those situations. So Jewishly, again, the thought would be, especially in like Hasidut, that forgiveness is a win-win. Because it liberates you and it liberates them. And it's a thing, both the apologizing and the forgiving is something that both parties need, and it's actually addressing both of their needs at the same time at a certain level. The most powerful example I know of this is the picture in front of you right now from the Vietnam War. Right, it's a picture that was taken in 1972. The circumstances are as follows. There was an Air Force pilot named John Plummer. who was told by Bass to go and drop his ordinance on a village. Ordinance means napalm. Napalm means that as soon as it hits your skin, your body's on fire. It's incendiary on contact. But he was misinformed, and there were people in the village, and they died or were horribly disfigured. And one of those people is in the picture in the foreground. It's a woman named Phan Thi Kim Phuc. This happened to her village. She was sitting in a pagoda when the bombs dropped. She was on fire. She was running down the street. That which did not melt, she was ripping off of her body. And so by the time she caught the lens of the AP photographer, she was without clothing. And this picture was very influential in the United States. At that time, it actually impacted people and were horrified and had certain connotations for the continuation of the war. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about what happened to her afterwards and what happened to John Plummer afterwards. As you well know, for many vets, doing this kind of thing is traumatic. We now talk about PTSD, but back when it was barely categorized, John Plummer's life spiraled down after the war in understandable ways. He got divorced, started to drink, things went badly. He was absolutely traumatized by the notion that he had done this. He said he could not live, could not sleep, could not eat, could not breathe. Every night, all the time. Got a little better because he met a woman who became his second wife, who was a born-again Christian. He became a Christian. His life began to move in positive directions, but he was still quite haunted. Now, cut forward 24 years, 1996. The girl, who's now a young woman, is speaking at the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington in 1996. And his friends tell John Plummer, you should go, and you should meet her. Now you can imagine how terrifying this would be, right? Truly terrifying. What do you say? But he goes, big crowd, she gives a speech. She does not know that he is in the crowd. And this is what she says at the bottom of the page in source number 3. She says, if I could talk face to face with the pilot who dropped the bombs, I would tell him we cannot change history, but we should try to do good things for the present. Plummer in the audience wrote her a note, I am that man. Right? So the note gets passed up to her, and her entourage kind of guides her along, and his friends kind of guide him along, and there, 24 years later, there they are. He's here, she's there. Right? About as intense as it's going to get in this world. So what happened was, he says, she just opened her arms to me. All I could say was, I'm so sorry, I'm just so sorry. It's all right, she responded. I forgive, I forgive. He said, I was floating, I was free, I was finally at peace. Now, there were other elements to release him. It wasn't just her saying this, but he definitely needed that component. He needed to not go to sleep every night and think he was this evil man. And they were both liberated in one fell swoop, and this is them together at the top of the next page. When you approach the days before Yom Kippur and Yom Kippur itself, don't think of this business of apologizing, forgiveness, all that stuff as kind of like a sideline. Like life goes on and then kind of sometimes stuff happens and we got to address it. I don't believe that's correct. I actually think that learning to do this scene well in life is a huge life skill. It entails thinking about how you communicate, how you validate, how you listen, how you move forward through difficult things. It's a huge life skill, and it happens constantly, constantly. Robert Caron, in number 4 in his book, The Forgiving Self, says it like this. He says, all sustained relationships depend to some extent on forgiveness. People hurt each other, no matter how much love they share, and it's a truism that the greatest hurts are meted out by the closest of intimates. No friendship, no marriage, no family connections of any kind would last if the silent, reparative force of forgiveness were not working almost constantly to counteract the corrosive effects of resentment and bitterness. Without forgiveness, there could be no allowance for human frailty. We'd keep moving on, searching for perfect connections with mythical partners who would never hurt or disappoint. It's a life skill. It's all the time. It's something that happens to us constantly. My impression is that all of us are actually, you know, fairly sensitive. We hurt. We experience things. We don't like it. We want approval. And it hurts. And you got to assume that's true for the other person too. So you got to assume that stuff's on the table a lot, right? A lot of people go through the day not even knowing the stuff they've done to other people. You know, that really kind of bothered me what you said yesterday. That's how we shake it off. We do stuff with it, but we do things to each other, not meaning to a lot of the time. So this is something we try to learn to do. How can Judaism, let's pick up on your question from last session, how can Judaism help us with this business? So one of the things that we see in Jewish sources is that there's a sequence that's optimal and there's a timing that's optimal. Just because you want to have this conversation doesn't necessarily mean the other person's ready for that conversation. And so having a certain kind of sensitivity to the process, as opposed to we have to do this now, is important. This is illustrated in the source at the bottom of the page, number 5, which is a sort of one of those quirky Talmudic tales. Here you have Reb Zerah. When he had a grievance against somebody, he would pass by them repeatedly and show he was willing to reconcile so they'd come out and appease him. So Reb Zerah likes to make himself available. He doesn't push himself on people. He likes to make himself available. Like, I'm here, the person I don't like is in the party with me, so instead of making a beeline for the other corner of the room, counterintuitively, I'm actually going to be right near them if they want to talk. But I'm not going to bug them. Then the next story in the Talmud, which seems to be commenting on the previous story, is a story about Rav on Erev Yom Kippur. So a certain butcher had acted meanly towards Rav, they hadn't apologized. So Erev Yom Kippur, Rav says, I'm going to go appease him. I'm going to actually make peace with him. So he meets a student, Rav Huna. And Rav Huna says, where are you going, master? And he said, to appease so-and-so. And Rav Huna says, bizarrely, Abba's about to cause someone's death. You know when you do that, someone's going to die. So Rav comes and stands over the butcher, and the butcher's like chopping meat. And the butcher like foists him off, says, I don't have anything to say to you. And then he chops a bone, the bone falls up, you know, rises up, hits him in the throat, and he dies. Bracket, only in the Talmud. But I think that there's a kind of intertextual comment going on here between the two stories. It's one thing to be available, it's another thing to try and accelerate it when the other person's nowhere near having that conversation. So we also have to calibrate a certain kind of patience because we're in a spot here. We know we can't let it go forever, like we really do need to have this conversation, but maybe they're not ready for it. So that's a very individual kind of judgment, like maybe I brought it up a bit too soon, but maybe at a certain point it's not me, it's them, they just can't handle any conversation. So you have to think carefully about the timing. But having said that, more importantly, let's think about the process. Let's think about the process. So, what's the first step in creating this forgiveness reality? What's the first thing that has to happen?
One of the sides has to take the first step.
Which side?
The injured side.
What does the injured side have to do?
They have to voice their resentment.
The injured side has to say, you hurt me. Which sounds so simple and happens so seldom. The injured side has to communicate, you hurt me. People have this impression that it's kind of a religious value, a mitzvah, to be martyrs, to suffer in silence. You know, you did all this stuff to me, but no, it's okay. And that somehow, that's great. It's like hafuch. Judaism does not teach that at all. Judaism actually teaches, and I'm speaking here halachically, the exact opposite, right? It's actually a mitzvah daraita to tell the person when they have pained you. The Rambam codifies it in Hilchot Deot at the bottom of the page in source number 6. And he says very plainly why. He says, whoever hates another in his heart transgresses the Torah prohibition, al tisna techicha bilvavecha, don't hate your brother in your heart. Right? The assumption being here that you won't do anything about it, but you'll silently seethe with resentment and leak it out in all sorts of ways. When one wrongs another, the latter should not remain silent. Rather, he's commanded to make the matter known and say, why did you do this to me? Why did you wrong me regarding that matter? Right? That's the first step. That's the key step, is to tell them you're over it. Right? So, people don't always do this. Why?
Sometimes it's hard or scary to tell someone.
Why? Why is it hard and scary?
Because maybe they will be dismissive. Maybe they'll get upset at hearing what it is they've done. Maybe they'll hurt you in another way.
Right. So it's hard. It is hard and scary. Those great words. Hard and scary. Fear of rejection. Right? They're going to traumatize you again. You're going to be vulnerable. You're going to risk it. You're going to say you hurt me, and they're going to say, no, nothing happened, and now you feel worse. So there's risk involved. So some of the things we do is we preempt, right? We preempt the conversation because of that fear of rejection, right? Guy's car breaks down in the desert, flat tire. He's got to get a jack to pump up the spare tire. There's almost nobody around. It's late at night. He goes, there's like one house with a light on. It's like a mile or so till he gets there. And in that time, he's like thinking to himself, I got one shot at this. I've got to ask for help. And if they say no, or they don't answer the door, or what am I going to do? And I have to think about how am I going to do. So he's having this running argument, you know, rehearsing what this other person's going to say. Knocks on the door. Person opens the door. He says, hi, can I help you? And the guy says, fine, keep your bloody jack. Turns around, walks away. It's better the vulgar version, but this is a family show, so anyway. That's what we do. We do it all the time. Keep your jack. Meaning, I'm not starting the conversation with you. I've already figured out that you're going to reject me, so we're not even going to talk. Right? So the Rambam is pushing you here. He's pushing you to initiate, even though it's hard, even though something will happen, because if that doesn't happen, nothing's going to happen. What's another reason we don't communicate that first step?
To relive the experience.
Sorry?
To relive the
yeah, hurt. You don't want to relive the experience. It's painful, right? What might else be going on? Yeah? Do they?
I think they do. And it's like rubbing it in.
Well, maybe. I mean, but they haven't said anything to you. But let's stick with do they know, right? So we assume people know. Or I think something else is going on, right? Which is that we're enraged at having to tell them. What we think they should know. Right, so partly it's fear and partly it's frustration, right? You've probably gone through this a million times, like, how can't you know that you did that? How can't you know that? Like, and you're so upset at the idea that I have to actually tell you something that was so plain. Like, why? What did I do? I understand. You cheated with 12 women this year. What did I do? Like, I have to tell you? I actually have to explain this to you, right? So you're so angry at having to tell them. You're so angry that they're clueless, that they're oblivious. But the thing of it is maybe they are. So halachically, the idea around forgiveness is you have to tell them. Because they're not apologizing. And you know why they might not be apologizing? Because, hey, they don't know they did anything. Which is amazing to you. Really amazing. But it happens all the time. So this is the key. You have to overcome the fear of rejection, and the fear of confrontation, and the feeling this is ridiculous, they should know, and they're so oblivious, and we have to do it. And then, only then, do we get into, you know, the apology stuff we talked about before, whether you feel validated and so on, right? Apology, hopefully forgiveness.
But so, do you wait for them to say, I'm sorry?
As I said, I don't think it's like a quick thing. There's a process you're initiating here of communication where you're saying to them, I don't know if you know or you don't know, but this thing you did, and then you're sort of reading their signals. How are they dealing with it? Right? Do they apologize? Are they capable of apologizing? Is it more complicated? Do they want something from you? Like all that stuff we've been talking about, but you're just opening that door to that more complex communication, because without it, things really can get stuck, and they can get stuck for a very long time. There's a really, to my mind, a fascinating passage in the Torah, a pair of passages that I think go together, if you turn the page, in sources 7 and 8, right? This is where the quintessential sort of quote-unquote forgiveness scene in Bereishit. Right? You all know the story, Joseph and his brothers. Joseph's kidnapped by his brothers. He goes down to Egypt. He's second in command of Egypt. He solves the grain problem in Egypt. Everybody has to come to Egypt to buy grain. His brothers come. He recognizes them right away. It's been many years. They don't recognize him. So in this scene, at the beginning of Parshat Vayigash, in chapter 45, he reveals himself to them, and he says, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were astounded at his presence. So he said, come near to me, please. He said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold unto Egypt. Don't be distressed or angry with yourselves, because you sold me, for God sent me before you to preserve life. And he talks about how the famine has been there, and God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth. What is not in this scene? What's not here? Apology's not here. They didn't do anything. They didn't say anything, right? And I don't even know if he's communicating his hurt, right? I don't even think the first step is here. Nothing is here. So the usual leap here would be to say, well, it's Joseph. Tzaddik. So isn't it better? Isn't it better for all if he's able to take it and he's able to like grant them this dispensation? And isn't it better? And the answer is no, it's not better. And we get proof, textual proof from this in the source underneath, in source number 8. Many years later, Yaakov dies in source number 8. And when Yaakov dies, almost Pavlovian, what's their response? Perhaps Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. Huh? I thought we were all good, like years before, but we weren't all good. If people let you off the hook, don't consider it a blessing. Unless you earn that forgiveness. If you know when you've done something to somebody, and the only way it's solid and trustworthy, not for them, for you, the only way you'll really trust that we're on solid ground is if you go through the pain of apologizing and really validating, because then you'll know, like, you earned it, and they know. Otherwise, you just sit around thinking, how did I get away with that? So the Torah itself does not appreciate the model of just like letting people go, like a saint, because it's not good for them. Because they actually, if it was good for Joseph, that's one thing, but it wasn't good for his brothers. Because they never trusted it. You have this terrible scene at the end of their lives where it all comes tumbling down. They needed to do the work, and he didn't give them that opportunity. So for Judaism, this is the sequence. Whether or not we feel comfortable, but we have to communicate it. We have to assess the apology stage, and then we get into all the complicated stuff that I talked about earlier. Let's stop and do an exercise in the middle of the page. Think about one situation in your life, hook back up with that person, waiting to be resolved. Sorry, that's a typo that I've avoided dealing with this past year. Or 5 years, or 10 years, but how can I begin to address it? What would be my first move? Concentrate on the first move. Right? We're here. How do we get to hear. What can I do to do that? Okay, I'm going to end in a couple of minutes, just the last bit. So for me, the definition of being a grown-up is responsibility. Full stop. You have 12-year-olds who are fully grown up. You have people living in older bodies who are children. It's about being accountable, right? Very first narrative in the Bible brings it home, right? Chapter 2, Adam and Eve, romantic love. What does he say, right, in source? Number 9, near the bottom of the page, you know, you're the bone of my bones, the flesh of my flesh, you're everything, you're my one. Every, like, you know, pop song lyric you've ever heard. As soon as there's a situation where he has to take responsibility, it is almost comic. There's three entities in the world. We'll leave the snake to the side. God, her, him. What does he do? God comes along and says, did you eat from the tree? He goes, the woman you gave to me, she made me eat from it. There's like nobody left to blame now. This is like fantastic blame protocol. Like, I targeted everybody else I can do but me, and I went for it, right? That's the first narrative of the Torah, beyond the cosmology, which is not human, right? That's the first narrative. It's like growing up is responsibility, full stop. And it's interesting, the pathology kind of trickles down, because when Cain kills Abel, what does he say? Am I my brother's keeper? Where did he learn that from? So it's about being accountable is all part of that forgiveness process. Like, we talk about these things up in the air, but it's really up to us to decide, like, do I want to be accountable for the things I do, even though it's very painful for me to be accountable? Because I don't seem like such a nice person. And everybody does it. Everybody's prone to it. There are all sorts of stories in the Torah and Nevi'im about people not taking responsibility, including on the last page here, Melech David, who like has to have Nathan come and tell him this whole parable about a poor man, a rich man, until he finally gets it, like, I didn't do good here. Right. Okay. So let's do the last exercises here quietly, and I'm happy to take questions at this point. I mentioned this question before, under source 11, are there important things that people are trying to tell me, like all the time, that I refuse to hear? Can others communicate directly with me? Do they always have to kind of go around? And then at the bottom of the page, someone who I've had trouble forgiving in the past, but I think perhaps I might be able to do at present is X, and what am I going to do, right? If they show no ownership about what they did, what's my plan B? And the reverse, someone I know is upset with me is blank. Do I feel their issue or complaint with me has any validity? So when I do this exercise yearly, I think of the person, I think about where we're at, I write it down, I stick it in a post-it note, I stick it in my al-chaitz on Yom Kippur. Right next to all those nice communal al-chaitz, I stick them there. And I talk about it, I try and work it through, like, okay, I've targeted this thing that I need to do, and I got to think about how am I going to accomplish this in some way, what's my first step, I try and start small, but I try and lay out for myself, how would this process develop? I'm happy to take questions. You've hung in for a couple hours, it's warm in here, so I applaud you. We're good?
I have a question.
You have a question? Sure. Yep.
How is
how is validation possible if you feel that the person who claims that you have wronged them, you feel that their claim is unjustified and baseless and silly?
Right. So what you do with that is you're now moving into forgiveness as understanding, and you're asking yourself, you're trying to stretch yourself into saying, is there any possible way that there could be some merit to what they're saying based on where they're coming from, how they interpreted my actions? There can be all sorts of intermediate conversations. It doesn't have to be black or white. You can feel that the substance of their claim is not true, but you can sort of understand based on a sentence you said or a tone you had or something you did that you contradicted later, that, okay, I can see why that upsets you. So partial validation is also pretty important, right? You can stand your ground, but still be admitting of the part that may actually be right. I think people want to see in us some kind of openness to some other perspective. Like, you know, obviously their fantasy is that we, you know, surrender all together and see all their way, but that doesn't happen often. But if you can say, you know what, I still feel like this is what I was trying to do, this is my intention, if you think about it, like I was consistent, whatever it is, but I could see why, I really could, and I'm not just patronizing you, I can really see why, like when I said that, you thought that, and even better, when you add after that, so I'm going to have to think about, you know, trying to say that differently, or trying to make a change in that, and as you're giving them some security, some, you know, mama shot there to say, okay, I think they get it. Because that's the thing, is that people want to feel like you get it. They understand you can't reverse it, can't take it back, can't erase it, but they want to feel going forward like, I have some confidence that after this discussion, you at least see X, even though you don't see, you know, X, Y, Z. Yes, ma'am. One of the really hard parts of this topic is sometimes the time runs out. So they're not ready, they're not ready, they're not ready. And I know several people, the people were ready and now they're not alive. Or you weren't ready and they're not alive, which is really painful because you're never going to be able to make it up, sort of thing. So, I mean, apart from the forgiveness part is a piece that I would call mourning, as in avilut. Not just for, like, sitting Shiva, but you're always mourning, because there's always losses. And it's a very key life skill to learn how to mourn things, like how to grieve them, how to work them through. I can't change the past, but I am grieving what occurred between us, and I'm coming out the other side. It's not clean, but there's nothing you can do, and the simple fact is that we don't control anybody else but ourselves. Nobody. We don't control anything in life. You can do what you do, you try and be your best person, but you're not going to control the other person. If they're not ready, they're not ready. In which case, it's thrown back to you, and you have to mourn it. And, you know, that's how it goes. Yeah?
When you are waiting, or you want the apology from someone, you also apologize yourself, even though you know you haven't done anything wrong?
You haven't done anything wrong? Like zero. You're blameless, and you're just going to apologize as being blameless?
I mean, I could find, like, what I did wrong, but, I was the one who got hurt. So, to draw out the apology, would it help to apologize myself?
I don't think you should do something fake. I think that you can have a conversation. Maybe the way you apologize is not apologizing, but just like understanding their perspective, where were you coming from? But no, I wouldn't produce anything that's not true for you, you know? But to the point, for each of us, we have to go a long way before we can just establish I am 100% blameless. But if you've reached that point, you're not going to artificially create something, you know? You can maybe do something in which you express that you're trying to understand them, but, you know, it's got to be what it is. All right. Anyway, thanks very much for being here.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.